Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, where you learn what you need to know about how the world wants to work. And now your host, coworking space owner and trend expert, Jamie Russo.
Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, episode number 129. I have a great guest and topic for you today. Really quickly before we dive in, happy holidays. It is the middle of December when you are listening to this, so things are probably a little bit crazy right now. I hope you're surviving, and I hope you can give this one a good listen. It's super helpful, super detailed, and very practical. So if you need to come back to it after the holidays, make sure to bookmark it. Before we jump in, quick announcement. I have an ebook up on Amazon. This has been a long time in the works, one of those projects that just dragged on. Finally got it up. It's great. I have some five-star reviews up there from folks who have been through it already. Easy for me to say it's great. I hope it's helpful. It's best for you if you have not yet opened a space. So it walks through 8 steps to creating a profitable co-working space that you love to run and covers topics like what is co-working today? Has a lot of things fall under that. A lot of different types of flexible workspace fall under that umbrella. Is starting a co-working space for me? What does the business model look like? What size space should I start? How much money does it cost to start a co-working space? What do I need to know about signing a commercial real estate lease and more? So if you want to check that out, head over to Amazon. The fastest way to find it is to search for my name, Jamie Russo. And you can search for co-working as well, but that gets you a few other books to sort through. It is 99 cents. It is free if you have Kindle Unlimited. There are ways, but they are fairly complicated to make it free if you don't have Kindle Unlimited. So it's 99 cents. I just wanted it to be super accessible. It is not excessively long. It's meant to be something you can get through fairly quickly, but to be comprehensive enough to kind of give you that framework to think about how to approach this journey. So grab it over in Amazon and leave a review if it's helpful to you. Send me an email if you have any feedback. Would certainly love to hear. So I'm going to dive right into today's guest, who is Kane Wilmot, co-founder and CEO at IQ Offices. He has been building his business over the last few years. When I first met Kane, I think he had one, maybe two locations, and he is booming and has so much to share about the process of the growth of his business. I could have him talk about 10 different topics, but today we are talking about the topics of using brokers, local brokers, as lead gen sources for your co-working space. Get a lot of questions about this, and Kane, he's such a sharer, as so many people are in this industry, but he in particular just dives right into the details of how what their program looks like and kind of the what's and whys, and I ask him some follow-up questions, and he gets into it all. So I will let you listen. Okay, today's very special guest is Kane Wilmot, co-founder and CEO at IQ Offices. And I kind of can't believe that Kane has not been on the podcast yet. I think I've been saving you and also recognizing how crazy busy you are. So Kane is the past president of the Global Workspace Association, so devoted lots of time and energy to helping us grow and evolve as an organization, and is busy expanding his own business, which we'll talk about in a minute. And it always shocked me how busy Kane was, but how no matter what was going on in his world, he always had time to help us work through something at the GWA, make our weekly calls. Talk to anybody who needs help with their own business. Kane is one of the most giving people in this industry, so I'm thrilled to have him on, and we are actually going to talk about working with brokers. Kane has a brokerage background and has a pretty unique program that he has developed to work with brokers in Canada, and we're going to dive into that in a minute. Kane, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be on this podcast. I've literally listened to every episode, so this is amazing. And there's over 100 now, is that right? Over 100?
Yeah, you are in the 130s.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Totally.
Yeah, that's so awesome. I love it. So many great podcasts. And thank you for that intro. That was so kind. That was very nice.
Totally. Well, yeah. Well, it's an exciting time to be a part of the industry, and I know you share that view. There's so much to talk about and so much to cover. So Kane, tell us a little bit about you. So you live in Toronto. Tell us about where to start. Talk about your business and then we'll kind of go into the background. So I'd love to hear the story of how you get started in co-working and a little bit about your business today, your locations, and not to pile too much into this first question, but a little bit about the uniqueness of your brand, because you have worked hard to kind of differentiate your offering and you're very clear about who you serve. So I'd love to kind of wrap that into an intro.
All right, that sounds good. Okay, so I'll give my kind of elevator pitch about IQ. So we started in 2012. I've been a real estate broker since 1998, so I'm old.
You can't call yourself old. No.
So been in real estate brokers for over 20 years, so that is a long time. But we started our own brokerage, myself and my business partner, Alex Sharp, in 2009. And after work at multiple brokerages before that, in 2011, we looked at co-working as being an opportunity for us to expand and really grow something. At the time, we were really focused on looking at businesses that were not as transactional as a real estate brokerage. So we're looking at something where we could really build up cash flows and really have a replicatable model was really what we were focused on at the time. And we were actually in a co-working space and a couple of co-working spaces ourselves as the real estate brokerage before we started our own co-working space. So in 2011, Alex and I went down to New York and we saw WeWork's second location in Soho. It was 200,000 square feet. And it was like one of
their
the craziest
second location was 200,000 square feet.
Yeah.
I don't think I realized that. Wow.
It was
go
massive
big or go
building.
Home. Yeah.
You got it. Yeah. So, yeah. And we had seen nothing like that in Toronto. So What was in Toronto at the time was a couple of small co-working operators and Regus really were dominating the marketplace. And so we went down, loved all the design. But one of the challenges we found with the model was the lack of privacy in the space. And the challenge was like sharing space, yes, but do we need to share our IP and do we need to share our confidential conversations and our whiteboards and our computer screens and like all those things with other companies. So when we came back and we started to look at planning out this business of IQ, we really looked at what it would take to create privacy within those spaces. So I'll try not to draw on too long on this, but really what we focused on a number of different elements from the privacy perspective. We put sound attenuation within our space, which is like enterprise quality. It's like white noise, except it's the, you know, the very high end version of that, which really adds to the privacy because you can't make out what people say between two different, it's like a crowded restaurant where you hear voices, but you can't make out the conversation. It takes out the high and low pitch. So we put that in our space. We also put extra insulation between the walls. We put privacy screening on our walls and we used a technology that created individual VLANs, private VLANs. So everyone wasn't on an open network. And in today's environment, I think, you know, with One Systems and Essensys, I think a lot of people have heard of that. In 2012, that was really cutting edge. And it was One Systems that was offering it. And so we put that into our space. And, you know, we opened up day one in 2012. We didn't have one office leased. We had no heating or cooling in the building. They were doing renovation on the inside, outside. So, you know, it was freezing cold. We were sitting in the corner office. I could see my breath. We hadn't leased out one office. And I'm like, oh my God, what have we done? You know, is anybody actually going to like this? So anyway, we did end up leasing it up. Our pro forma was 12 months. We did it in 9. And, you know, we found that there was a need for our product. We really kind of, from a differentiation perspective, we lucked into having a need for ourselves that we filled. And it also filled a gap in the market. And so that's something that we continue to focus on.
I think one of the interesting pieces of your branding is those were early days. And for you to sort of make this bet and be super clear and sort of like a little bit brave in terms of higher investment to do the type of space you were doing, like to not at some point be like, we don't really need the sound thing. It's kind of pricey. Like, let's cut the corners. Like, you really stuck to who are you serving and what is your differentiation? And even though you had to, you know, invest more upfront, you're seeing that paying off over time. And it can be hard to do at the beginning when you're not sure.
100%, you know, and with co-working now, we're starting to pre-lease spaces because we've been doing it for a while. So we know a little bit more about what we were doing. I mean, at the time we had a Wix website and no SEO whatsoever, you know, and so I mean, our timing was really good in terms of when we came into the market. But yes, I mean, I think that what we started with, which was, I think was smart, was we really thought about what our values were as an organization, like what we wanted to be, who we wanted to be. And one of the values that we had is, first of all, we wanted to create an amazing experience at work. That was one of the big things. So we thought about that through a high touch experience, having lots of staff on site, being very thoughtful about how we create these connected experiences with our members and our staff and our members and our members. And, you know, everybody that comes in touch with our brand. But then that privacy piece was something that was just so important to us all the way through that, we had to stick to it really at the time. And yes, there was lots of times where we were like, do we really want to spend $50,000 on this line item that no one ever sees?
Right.
So, but you know, it really has worked out for us. And again, you know, the timing was good, and that some of our competitors in the market don't have as much of a focus on the privacy, it creates a great differentiating point for us. So yeah, so it worked out to be a business model that we've been able to sustain.
So tell us what your business looks like today in terms of locations, and kind of, we were talking about square footage a little bit. What's your typical size? And you just mentioned a pretty significant expansion in Toronto, which gives you 60,000 square feet, but tell us a little bit about your portfolio.
So we have 4 locations in Toronto and 1 in Vancouver that are operational right now and running. In the next week, we're going to be opening up an expansion of 14,000 square feet, just over 14.8, at the Royal Center, which is an existing location in Vancouver, and then a brand new location of just over 13,000 square feet. And then we're going to be opening 24,000 square feet in Calgary on March 1st. Then Ottawa is 13,000 square feet on January 1st. We're going to be opening 35,000 square feet, all on one floor, pretty crazy building in downtown Montreal, which is exciting. That's March 1st. And then we're going to be doing 2 expansions here in Toronto, one on top of an existing location and the other one on top of existing location as well, one of which we're going to be putting our own office into. And in addition to that, we've been expanding our business model into what we call HQ by IQ. We love cheesy names, certainly not afraid of it. We got lots of them. So HQ by IQ is really looking at building our bigger spaces. We have some spaces now that can accommodate over 100 people in them, and they're all built out, completely ready to go. And so at our one location in Toronto, we're doing that. And we're also putting our head office into that location as well. And then we have another location in downtown Western Toronto where we've done that on 2 floors too.
I have Kane on video and he looks like he gets sleep, but one would wonder with all this going on. Although I have to mention, I mean, one of the favorite topics, I talked about how giving Kane is, but really he's also super smart. And I mean, you're super smart to start with. And also he just is one of those people who will ask a million questions, go visit operators, learn, and develop this amazing organization. So you said you have how many folks on your team today and growing?
Yeah, over 40. We should be over 60, I would say, in 2020. We keep on hiring people, which is, you know, it's such an amazing thing because there's such fulfillment in creating these livelihoods and what I hope to be the most amazing job. I always say, I understand people might not stay with us forever, but I always say it might not be your last job, but I hope it's your best job. And so I work really hard.
It's cheesy, but I love it.
It's total cheese. I told you we're not afraid of cheesy lines. Me specifically, I get chirped for it all the time. But you know, it's so true that if we can create an amazing day at work for all of our staff, and then by extension, we can do that for our members, I find that to be such purposeful work, you know, and it's so much fun. So now we're over 40 people. We're going to be over 60 people soon. So one of the real drivers of the growth is, first of all, just to serve our membership, that's one thing as well, because we're finding that we have a lot of satellite offices and they're in these other markets. So they like to have us in those markets as well. It's great to have a presence in those markets, but also too, from our staff's perspective and the team, there's a lot of growth available within the organization when you grow. So that's a real benefit of growth as well.
So Kane is really thoughtful about his team and his culture and how he develops people and develops his systems around supporting his team. And he did a presentation at the conference that we'll have to have him repeat at some point for folks that weren't there. If you were there, I think you can access that. Send us an email if you were there and want to see the recording if you missed it. But just about the evolution of the team and kind of staffing and developing. So Kane, we could go on and on about a lot of different topics. Well, let's talk about you a little bit personally. You live in Toronto. You have 2 kids who are big skiers. Can you talk about that for a minute? Ski season is upon us.
Yeah. So I actually live 2 hours north of Toronto in a little town called Collingwood, 20,000 people. It's a ski town. So there's 5 different ski resorts in this town. It's a 2-hour drive away. We had massive snow this past Monday. So it was 3.5 hours away. So it really depends on the day. Yeah. So it really depends on the day. But interestingly enough, we've been doing that for almost 9 years now, where I drive down to the city on Monday, I drive back up on Thursday, or I try to be there as much as I can on Fridays and spend that time with the family. Yeah, we're very busy in the wintertime because the kids are competitive freestyle skiers with jumps and rails. They're both on the provincial team here in Canada. And so they just got back from UConn this morning. And I do a lot of traveling. They do just as much travel through the wintertime as well. So it's pretty exciting. It's definitely a proud parent moment. And you know, my only regret on the whole thing is that I don't get to ski with them anymore because they're always training. And you know, we have so much fun skiing together. But I figured that'll all come back. you know, in their 20s, I'm hopeful. Anyway, right. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So today's topic. So we get a lot of folks trying to figure out how to work with brokers, and you have developed a program and you do a lot of education with your local brokers. Can you maybe start with, like, why should we be thinking about working with brokers as a lead source for co-working spaces, and maybe who is a fit for that and who may not be?
Yeah. Okay. So when we first started our co-working space in 2012 at our first location, it was 11,000 square feet. It's fairly small. I would say that we wouldn't do a location that small again. Even anything under 15,000 square feet would definitely be on the lower side. We'd like to do 25 is kind of our sweet spot. But back, and why I say that is because back in 2012, we had all these broker relationships because I had been a broker since 1998. Yeah. I thought, oh, I'm going to talk to all my friends and they're all going to fill up the space for us. This is going to be amazing. And then no one came. So in terms of the brokerage participation, and I was surprised, and I talked to people about it, and what it really came down to is with the smaller spaces, so I should back up a little bit, on our first location, the largest office that we did was 6 people.
Okay.
So, and at the time, it was 6 people. In Toronto, we were charging $5,200 for it, and I swear I was so afraid of, we had 2 of them. I was so afraid of these 2 offices because it was a concentration of rental rate risk, yeah. And I was concerned that no one was ever going to pay that. And they were the first ones to get filled. They've always been filled. It's, you know, the larger we build it, the better the company, when I say the better, I mean, the larger the organization, the better the covenant in terms of the credit risk associated with them. And I find that the longer they stay, and for us in terms of aligning with our brand, they really appreciate what it is that we have to offer. So that is going forward. But if I rewind back to 2012 and I look at when we had all the smaller offices, I was finding it was difficult to get the brokerage community engaged in bringing groups, smaller groups. Yeah. And I think the main reason why is just because from a broker's perspective, it's really based on what does the comp look like. And what from a broker to large brokerage shop, they have to do a split with the house and so on and so forth. And they got to do a lot of transactions if they're small, or, you know, rely on those big transactions to make a good living. So I found that it was difficult to entice brokers to really take co-working seriously and have it front of mind, because it's just, it wasn't big enough for that to be the case.
And at the time, did they understand what it was?
I think that was part of it too, yeah. Right? There wasn't a lot of awareness in the market. Most of the people that I talked to about our business said, oh, that's a great idea. How'd you come up with it? Right?
Right.
Of course I didn't. And yeah. So, but people would be like, oh, that's such a great business. Oh, I really like that idea. You know, so it was an education all the way around, like education everywhere I went, from dinner parties to our sales cycles, to speaking to brokers, anyone that I would talk to about co-working, because, you know, I like to talk to anybody about it that will listen, I'd have to take them up the learning curve. And what I found is over the past few years with some of the larger operators in the market, that there has been so much awareness, which is fantastic. So I think that you're right. There's 2 pieces to it. I think 1 piece to it was the awareness of, like, this is small. What is it? I don't really know. I don't really want to take the time to get to know, because it doesn't really make a whole lot of compensation for me. But I think in addition to that, with the smaller spaces, it was difficult for them to really kind of to take it seriously. And then I think what now with the bigger awareness, with people building bigger spaces, and that's the piece that I was getting to in terms of our development over time, is that we started to build bigger offices. So that 6 person went to a 12 person at our second location, went to a 30 person at our fourth location. We have some that are over 100 people because there's just such a need for it. And it's really been driven by the awareness piece in the market. And that has really created a shift. I see there's a huge shift happening in the market right now where it's a zero-sum game in some cases, where you have an office tenancy who would be looking for 5,000 square feet, who's now saying, no, I don't want to build it out. I don't want to sign a long-term lease. I want to get into the space quickly. I want to have it serve my needs, and I want to have flexibility because I don't have any visibility beyond the next quarter of how big we're going to be. Because I would fit into that boat, because your headcount, you just don't know. So I find that there's an adoption in the market, and now the brokers are seeing this as, wait a minute. So this is a 100-person requirement that they can accommodate. Now this is something worth looking at, right?
Yep.
And the customers, being the tenants, are starting to say, this is what I want. So now there's a lot more focus on it. So we're kind of riding the wave on that a little bit, I would say. So the brokers know more about what we're doing. We're starting to see a lot more engagement from the brokers community. But I can say that since 2012, even though we didn't have as much engagement, we still spent a lot of time servicing the brokers community, because we always believed that they had access to the tenancies. And we always thought, from a leverage perspective, we could go to a building and call every tenant in the building, which we don't do. But if we were to do that, it's trying to find a needle in a haystack. Whereas you talk to one broker, you could have access to, you know, hundreds of tenants that are out there potentially.
Yep.
And so they're such a great resource. And I think that overlooking them as being a lead source for you, I think is really blocking out one of the really good channels that you have for attracting people to your space.
Do you see sort of this awareness, interest in bringing leads? Is that consistent across markets? Like, does that present itself more strongly in Toronto, which is probably the largest market you're in? Or is that consistent in some of the smaller markets as well?
Well, yeah. So now we're in a number of different markets. Toronto's the largest market in Canada. That we're in Montreal, Vancouver, Calgary, and Ottawa. Ottawa is quite a small market. It's the smallest market that we're in right now. We have other couple of markets that we have our eyes on that are smaller too. But I find that it isn't really predicated on the size of the market. In fact, I find it much easier in smaller markets because there's way less brokers and real estate agents in a smaller market. So you can tap into that community much easier, which is fantastic. And you can get to know very quickly who the movers and shakers are. So our process is going into Ottawa as an example. We had a real estate broker at CB Richard Ellis who secured the space for us. We used him as a resource to say, like, who can we talk to at Avis and Young and JJL and Colliers and Cushman & Wakefield? I know I'm missing some, but all the different brokerage houses.
Yeah,
they made the introductions for us, which was fantastic. And then I went in and talked with all of them.
Even across the brokerages, they didn't hesitate to connect you to competitors, essentially.
Exactly. You know, and it's really interesting because in the real estate game, and because I was a broker for so long, people do tend to be fairly secretive.
You know, I was thinking that was sort of an advantage. It worked out to be an advantage when you started your space because brokers like hoard information, right? Like, that's part of the competitive advantage, you know, knowing stuff that your competitors don't know. So when you were talking about your space and like, I don't want people to see my screen and the whiteboard and, you know, some people think, well, that's collaborative. It's cool. We're all, you know, you're like, no, I got to hide it. It turned out to be, you know, you were onto something that other people felt too, but partly I assume that's where it came from.
You just drew a line there that I've never done before. That's very interesting. Yeah, you're right. Maybe that was it. Maybe because I worked as a broker for so long. And knowledge is power in brokerage in a lot of ways. I mean, it's not the only thing because relationships are at the heart of everything. But the knowledge was extremely important because if you knew that something was available that no one else knew was available, then you had a serious advantage. And if you were in the middle of a transaction that may or may not happen, the last thing you'd want is to frustrate that transaction by letting someone else know about it, right?
Right.
So that's really interesting. There's a dig into the psyche on that whole thing.
Totally.
That's a good one. I like that. I might explore that a little further. But yeah, I think the brokerage community now is super educated. In some markets where you don't have some of the larger competitors, they're not as educated.
Yep.
Most of them are reading the papers. Anybody who's in real estate has an interest in co-working. There's no one in real estate that we encounter now where we say we're in the co-working business. And they're like, what's that? So that's fantastic. So that really advances those conversations. So which is great. And it just helps us to get in front of more groups. And I can tell you that everyone's curious about it. The real estate brokers are curious about it. The property managers are curious about it. Developers, landlords, everybody's curious.
Yeah.
Everybody has an opinion, but they're curious, which helps because it starts those conversations.
So tell me about the workflow. So when you showed up in Ottawa and you asked for the intro, what happens then? How do you reach out? What does the education process look like? And then what kind of value proposition are you creating for the broker?
So ours might be a little bit unique because we came from a brokerage background. So I started in office leasing. So I literally sat in their seat before and I understand what it takes to put lease transactions together. I understand the difficulty of putting them together, the timelines and so forth. So when we sit down with the brokerage community, it's really talking about what are the differences between a traditional lease and a co-working space, just so they can understand it. And then from there, looking at, as a broker or as a real estate agent, how do you get involved in this? So if this really is transformational, which I believe that it is, and that co-working is going to be the new way consuming space up to a certain size, then it's something that they want to be educated on and understand. And so what we do is we go in and speak to the real estate brokerages about what is a co-working strategy for as a broker. And we talked to a number of landlords about the same thing. What is a co-working strategy for a landlord? And from a broker's perspective, there's some key differentiating pieces when you look at a traditional office space versus looking at a co-working space. And so we really highlight those and help them to understand kind of here's what the differentiators are between those two things. So we start high level there. And then we look at, well, what's the differentiator between IQ and some of the competitors there? So, and we look at it really more from a perspective of an education than we do as like a big advertising for IQ. I love the fact that it makes us very visible. I really think it's extremely important to connect personally with all of the brokers and spend the time with them instead of just firing out mailers. It's really important to spend time and make those connections. So
people do business with those they know, like, and trust.
You got it. That's right. So I think it really starts there.
Do you meet with them one-on-one, or do you do, you've heard you talk about, you know, trying to get in on their quarterly meetings, or how do you like tactically get in front of them?
A few different ways. When we first go into a market, usually one-on-ones, where I just want to meet with whoever is an influencer within that shop. Sometimes it's the broker of record who's basically the boss and runs the shop. Sometimes it's one individual that's leading the charge and loves co-working and wants to hear more. So, and I utilize relationships with existing real estate agents and brokers within the market and say, who should I talk to? Who's of interest? Like, who would pick up the flag and wave it for us, within their own shop? And so it starts there. And then from there, we usually try to go to one of the sales meetings. Most brokers' houses have a sales meeting every week, like every Monday, every Tuesday, and usually it's in the mornings, not always. Like, there's definitely different ways of different companies doing it, but they'll have it on one day. And then we'll organize it so that we go in on that day. I'll usually bring in my regional person or my local person that they're going to be in contact with every single day, because I'm not in Vancouver all the time. So I'll bring in my community manager from Vancouver. And then we'll talk about this strategy. So I have this whole presentation that I put together. Sometimes I'm standing at the front of the room and I do the presentation like you're standing at a podium. Other times it's super casual and we have this, it's very interactive and we have lots of conversation. It just depends really on the engagement of the different people in the room. But it's a great opportunity to, number one, meet all those brokers, which is just great because they're such a great resource for co-working, number one. Number two, it's a great opportunity to really get out into the market, be seen from the organization's perspective. Yep. And I think that as well, that us educating brokers or us providing brokers with more information on co-working really helps everyone within the market. Like, I think it helps IQ.
Thanks, Jane. Right.
But we all do better from that. And I think that at the end of the day, we all have different products and different things. And I always say, it's not one thing, it's all the things that come together to make an organization. And it's never been my goal to be the only co-working space that one of my customers or prospects is going to see. That's never been my goal. Yep. My goal has always been, I want to be on the list. Please put me on the list.
Right.
So I think if you approach it from that perspective, have it less salesy, have it more about, I'm just trying to help everybody understand. And also too, I get all this feedback from real estate agents and brokers as well. Because I say, like, what will it take to put us on the list? And what are we doing wrong? What are we doing right? How can I make your life easier? I mean, what's interesting is our business is very much predicated on reducing friction from a transaction process, from getting into space, from creating a better workday. But there's all the areas of the business that you have to look at reducing friction. The sales cycles that you have, the real estate brokers, like, if you make it difficult for them to get access to your information and you give it to them in little bits and piecemeal, and when they call, they don't get a call back for 48 hours.
You know how I feel about the phone. Yeah.
You got it. That's right. For sure.
Answer that phone. I mean, not to jump into the kind of end value proposition too quickly, but to your point, for brokers, getting a lease done could take a year, right? Moving 100 people into your space could take weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've done 2 weeks where we had a group move in. Within less than a month, a broker was paid well over $100,000 in commission. Yeah. So, I mean, it was a great transaction for them, a great transaction for us. We ended up opening up this floor. So we had this ability to do this HQ by IQ, as we call it. And so, I mean, it's a great value proposition for the broker's perspective. And yes, when I was doing office leasing, if I get paid within 1 year from the time that I had met somebody, that was lightning fast. I mean, it could take 6 months to get an LOI, a letter of intent done. Never mind.
For all the people out there trying to sign leases, they're like, oh, it's wild. I mean, I love how you put, the friction in this industry still on the traditional commercial leasing is so painful. So you don't have to share all your secret sauce, but what's a framework for compensating a broker? I get asked this all the time. A, how do you get them to pay attention to you, which you've started to talk about? And then B, how do you compensate them?
Yeah. So we really follow what has been industry standard in every market that we've seen, which is 10% of the reoccurring spend on the first year and then 2% for every year after that. So that's what we pay. And we've really stuck to it. Interestingly enough, I don't find that doing bonus commissions in that really make all that much of a difference. I've tested it. Didn't really help. I would say that either your space works or it doesn't. Yeah. If you have a good relationship with a real estate broker, they're going to put you on the list because they want to see if it works or not. If one space is paying a bonus commission over another space, not paying a bonus commission, I mean, I think for a lot of the brokers that I deal with, that doesn't really come into the value prop for them. Yeah. Like,
they also need to find the right fit for their client, right? So if the guy really paying the bonus is, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So either it fits or it doesn't, right? And in addition to that, it's usually a relatively short-term transaction. So they want to make sure, what's most important is make sure that their client is happy.
Yeah.
Because they're probably going to get them back in a year or two.
Which is another advantage, right? They can kind of keep tabs. They know where they are. You know, they can come in if they need to. Like, if that 100 people is going to turn into, you know, 300 people and look for their own space, then the broker is able to kind of stay with them and follow them and find them a short-term solution. What do you pay them up front?
Yes. Yeah, so as soon as we pay them within 15 days of occupancy of the space. So once we receive the security deposit, for us, we do two months security deposit and then a first month's rent. So once they've been in the space for 15 days, then check gets cut.
Okay. But you're floating some of that commission essentially. So you need to have the capital to support that.
Yeah, no, because we use our security deposits to pay them.
Okay. So that'll generally cover it. Okay.
Generally cover it. Yes. In some instances, it might not, if it was a very long-term transaction. We don't really do overly long-term transactions, but it's one of the important things of having 2 months security deposit up front, having access to it, because we do have to manage our cash flows.
Match that. Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
So for folks who don't have spaces that are, you know, not going to put in 100 people in smaller markets where they might get attention from brokers for smaller offices, does it, from your perspective, I've heard people talk about, you know, well, I get the brokers in, you know, happy hour, beer, you know, food, whatever, and then I'll pay them like with Amazon cards, like because the smaller deals are not sort of worth it when they have to split it with the house. Have you seen that or done that in the early days? Or what would you recommend in cases where we're talking about smaller deals?
So that one's a little tricky. And because I am a real estate broker, I've worked at brokerage shops. I understand a little bit of the politics going on in the background. I don't know if politics is the right word, but I understand the structure of what's going on in the background. How's that? That's a better word. And so if you look at a real estate brokerage, they may take up to 50% of the commission. So if a real estate broker makes $100,000, $50,000 will go to the shop. Whatever that amount is, maybe it's 5% and it's a residential brokerage, whatever that split is, if you pay a broker directly in a gift card, then you're effectively cutting out the brokerage from making a profit on that.
Yep.
And that is kind of isolating the group that you're really wanting to support you in that local market. So I think it's a little bit tricky.
So you're risking the relationship sort of with the house. Like maybe you've got a relationship with a specific broker, but if they know, if they sort of are aware of that, then that's risky from a longer term relationship perspective.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, everybody's got their tolerance on those sorts of things, right?
Yep.
From our perspective, I like to get an invoice and I like to pay the invoice and I like to be super fair and I like to pay everyone really, really fast, right? And make sure that they love doing business with us. That's really my focus. So, you know, I know people do it. I know it's been done. From our perspective, though, we want to make sure that everybody who's owed is due or due.
Yes.
Who's owed. You know the word I'm looking for here, right? Yeah, there we go. It's owed is paid. There we go. Thank you.
Do you have any recommendations for people who have, you know, say you have 13,000 square feet and you still have, I don't know how many offices that is, 25 offices to fill. Like, is it worth creating a relationship with a local broker or multiple brokers in that case?
100%.
And you get their attention. Okay.
100%. Because I think that one of the things that we had a challenge with early days is that we had smaller offices. But to your point, the bigger challenge was that the people just didn't know what we did. So you had to take them up this huge education curve for fairly small amount of dollars at the end of the day. Whereas now everybody knows what co-working is. And brokers, there is usually what I found when I was in real estate brokerage is the smaller the requirement, the more of them there are. So what that means is that there's 10 or 15 1,000 square foot requirements for every 10,000 square foot requirement.
Oh, yeah.
There, right?
I think that's one of the surprising things about our industry. It's like, I think the stat is like 80% of commercial leases are under 5,000 square feet. It's like shocking. You know, we think of large, you know, people taking down, you know, 30, 50, 100,000 square feet. And that's just rare, to your point. So
there's a huge market for those people. And now as an operator, you have the benefit of built-in awareness because the brokers already know what you're selling.
Yep.
So, but I think also too, you have to attack it for a bunch of different angles. If you do a broker reception, have a bunch of people over and give them free beer or whatever, you know, prizes, whatever the case may be, that's one thing. I think it drives the awareness piece But if you really want to get people to send people your way, you have to spend time with them. You have to connect with them. You have to have a relationship where they trust you, where a 1,000-square-foot requirement comes in and immediately they give you a call because you're just the obvious choice. Yeah. They know you're going to take care of them. They know that if they grow or something happens and they're going to be leaving the space, that you're going to contact them again. Right. And I think that that's one of the things that it's so time consuming. It really is.
Right.
But
I was thinking, you have to really commit. It's not a one and done. Have people over, give them your card. It's ongoing relation. You have to stay in front of them. It's like any sort of long-term sales process. You have to keep that relationship and get those touch points in every so often.
And ask the right questions. So when you're in front of a real estate broker, if you have some space or a specific need, talking to them about it, saying, what are you, you know, we've got this in, maybe you're in the suburbs of Chicago. I've got this 5-person office in Chicago. Like, are you running around with any small requirements in the last month? Has anybody inquired on 1,000 square feet or, right? So you just asking those sort of questions, keeping it front of mind. If they say, oh yeah, I got an email on that a few days ago. We showed them a couple of spaces. I'm not sure where it's going to go. Oh, fire over the email. Let's see how it goes. So those are the kind of things that can really bear fruit.
So we talked a little bit about kind of developing a relationship. Anything else about sort of in reducing friction for them, make it easy to, you know, to work with you, and then the compensation. Is there anything else sort of in the program that we should be thinking about?
Well, the compensation piece is huge.
Yeah.
Because if you look at it, like when we're doing a comparison, a commission on a 1-year transaction is as much as a 5-year transaction on a traditional office basis. So that is really compelling. And so if you're going to do a 5-year deal, it's going to be substantially more. So you get paid, like, it's just such an obvious to put it onto the list because you get paid faster, you get paid more. It's what the client wants, right? It's easy to show, it's easy to do the transaction, and you get them back in a shorter period of time. You're not waiting out a 5 or 10 year lease. So from the broker's perspective, there's a lot of value propositions built into that.
Yep. I could still see some education probably in some markets that needs to be done to sort of uncover that for them, to help them, you know, frame it up and help them see even some, I think you do, you have a sheet with some math and examples on it to help them like really drive it home.
Yeah. It's not like you say one and done, just saying it once does not necessarily get the message out there to everyone. I've been talking about the relationship on the commission side and talking about getting the clients back. Like I've been talking about this for years now. And even still, there's many times where I talk with real estate brokers, and it's because we pay them every quarter. If it's a shorter commitment, as an example, like let's say we do a 6-month and then they stay for an extra quarter, well, we pay them on that quarter. Then we pay them the next quarter. So, and one of the challenges as a real estate broker is that sometimes you'll put a tenant into a building, and this isn't true for all buildings, but for some, that you'll put them into a building, and when it comes time for renewal, that it may be difficult to get protected on a fee on that. So with ours, it's set it and forget it. You know, their client goes into the space, they get paid every quarter. They don't have to call us and say, you know, I need to, you know, renegotiate or whatever the case may be in order for us to extend this so that we can take advantage of more commission. It just automatically comes in. So it really makes a whole lot of sense from that perspective. Again, reducing the friction in the process.
Who on your team is responsible for tracking this and doing the payouts?
Oh, accounting. And it is, you should see the spreadsheet. It is.
Well, that's what I should say. It's like, oh boy, this is a commitment, right?
Yeah. So, because not only do we pay 10% for the first year and then it knocks down to 2% for every year after the first year. So that has its own complexity, but it seems, you know, relatively straightforward to deal with. But if you have a client who stays for 6 months or a member who stays for 6 months and then they go and they grow into twice the size space. So let's say they go from a 10 to a 20.
Okay.
Then on the original 10, they get paid 10% for the first year, two after. Okay. And then it resets on the growth piece, which would be the extra 10 people, right? So now that would be for a year, that would be 10%. So that's what I mean about the whole
crazy
spreadsheet.
Got it.
So you need a crazy spreadsheet to do it.
But is your local team responsible for feeding that data up? Like when somebody expands, they need to make sure accounting knows, or is that the sales team that handles that?
Yeah, it's the community manager at the location that would say, I'm going to be expanding this group. Now, everything's documented. So if we're going to expand them into a larger office, we have an amending agreement. So we would have the amending agreement signed. Yeah. At that point, that goes to accounting. When accounting looks at that, one of the checkbox, is this a broker transaction?
Got it. Yep. So do you see a point where brokers are sort of becoming so savvy that, and again, rising tide lift all boats, so not necessarily feeling one way or another, but are brokers going to start sort of saying to landlords, well, I'll just manage this for you within your building? I mean, it goes back to the whole like, you know, how much service do you need is maybe a long answer, but are brokers becoming savvy enough that they could sort of manage this process for a landlord?
The process of running the space?
Like a shorter, yeah, like the 100 person requirement, for example. I mean, I guess the, I'm thinking through the question more. I mean, they're not going to handle the furnishing and the design, and it's not really possible unless the landlord is going to get involved from a design the space, fit out the space, sort of create a turnkey suite. There's not really a way for a broker to do this without you.
I mean, I think that brokers, depending on what we're talking about in terms of the different areas of the brokerage, you have Hannah with CBRE.
Yep.
So you do have brokerages out there that are looking at it. I think they're looking at it more from a property management perspective than they are from a broker's perspective.
Yeah.
So I think they're looking at it as, we do property management, it stops here. What can we do to expand the property management business into more of a catered business? And how can we service small suites? And that's what we're seeing on that side. And I think there's so much space in this market that, and we're only seeing the beginning of this wave of demand that's coming in terms of these groups that are coming off these long-term leases that are now saying, whoa, look at all the options. This didn't even exist 5 years ago when I signed my lease.
Yep.
So there's a need for show suites. There's a need for large suites on a short-term basis, flexible, built out and ready to go. There's a need for subleases, obviously, but under a more friction-free model. But, and there's, I believe that there'll always be a place now for a real hospitality-focused space. And I think so when I look at that, one of the threats to our business is that you have landlords come into the business and they decide they're going to do it themselves, right?
Yeah.
And I think when I look at that, first of all, I think that makes us all better when there's more competition in the market. But I think that what we really need to focus on as an organization is, how do we really create this amazing experience for our, like a Ritz-like experience where people enjoy coming to IQ so much so, right, that they become loyal to the brand. And you really are.
And it becomes their bar, right, for experience. I'm trying to remember who I was having this conversation with earlier this week. Oh, it was on the, I was talking to one of our GWA members who's doing some market research. And one of the questions they were sort of posing is, you know, do enterprise customers, does this just become the bar? And what do they, like if they've worked in an IQ and had this amazing experience with your, you know, Trail Mix bar and your amazing staff and privacy and beautiful spaces, you know, it's a great experience. Then, you know, they sort of don't want anything less than that, right? So if anybody is sort of getting into offerings, they have to find their sweet spot of who they can serve appropriately. Because, you know, you're right, you're serving who you're serving in a specific way. And there are a lot of people who are going to demand that. And where does that, right? Can the landlord deliver on that on their own?
Yeah, I think the niche is really important from a business model perspective. But I think what we're seeing as well is that what the customer wants is changing so rapidly. Like now we're doing treadmill phone booths and we're doing massage chairs and
Wait, do people actually use the treadmill phone booths?
Well, this was, so one of my thoughts was people like to walk and talk, myself included.
Yeah.
And so we,
if I could walk and do podcast interviews, I would. I know. It's like such a waste of time to be sitting here. Yeah.
I could be walking right now instead of sitting in this chair. So this was the thought. This is one of the ideas that we're floating. We've talked to members about it. It's been well received. So we're building them in our new location. So I will be able to tell you in 6 months, a year from now, whether these things are overused or this is just one of Kane's crazy ideas. Really was a crazy
idea. Are you going to put sensors in there to test?
Yes, I think that, well, we have sensors throughout some of our spaces, and the purpose of that is more to understand what the occupancy is in our space. So we want to make sure that we're never over-densifying our spaces.
Yep.
So yes, but there's occupancy. We can put sensors in the test. That would be really the 2.0 of understanding what some of the different groups are using and what's being utilized and not being utilized. Like we find the booth seating that you have like at a restaurant. Love booth seating, myself included, because it's just amazing to go and sit in that environment where you still have access to your office quickly, your private spaces quickly, but you can still be out in a where you have music and you have people and you know you're surrounded by action.
Totally. Okay. Well, you'll have to keep me posted on how the phone booths get utilized.
I will let you know how they get utilized. Yeah. I think for the perspective of looking at it in early days, it's just going to be seeing if people like it or if they're just like, wow, this is really weird.
It's weird. Totally. So. Maybe next time. Maybe next call.
Yeah. Maybe they go in and don't turn it on. I don't know. I guess we'll see.
Just stand there on the, Wait, does it take up the whole space? Like, is there a chair next to it or do you have to use the treadmill?
No, the space is built for the treadmill.
Okay.
So you open the door, it's got a treadmill, it's got a desk up top where you can put your computer and you can hop on the phone.
Do you have to add to your insurance to offer this?
That is a good question. I'm going to have to talk to my insurance provider to make sure.
I'm just picturing, like, you know, YouTube meme of somebody on a work call, like.
Totally. Yeah. Maybe we should put a pad behind it. I believe it only goes a certain speed, so I don't think it could throw you.
Probably.
People,
but, nobody's but yes. jogging while they do a call. I mean, no, you can't be breathing hard. Right. And yeah.
No, it's not meant to be a full workout. It's really meant to be just to keep you moving, right?
Totally. Get the steps in. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I know it may sound like a little bit of a crazy idea, but I mean, we're always focused on, like, what does it take to engage people at work? Like, so when you come into one of our spaces, you are fully engaged and you have all these different work environments that you can go to where you can have privacy or you can be social, or in this case, you can be active, right? Yeah. While you're doing your work. So, and I mean, I find myself personally, and in speaking to our members as well, is that they don't like to just sit at a desk all day long. That's why we do sit, stand desks in our space as well.
Totally.
Yeah. Yep. So just give you all these different environments.
I love it. Okay. Is there anything else that we need to cover on the brokerage topic? Anything I didn't ask that I should have?
We've covered a lot on the brokerage side. I think the big thing is that no matter what size of space that you have, they're still good to spend time with the brokerage community because they really know who's out there looking for space. That's the reality. And they also know when someone says, oh, I'm in a jam and I need somewhere to have an event. What do you know of any spaces and that sort of thing? You know, so like there's so many things that
they're so well networked, right? It's their job. Their job is
It literally is their job. So let's say like if you have five brokers even in your market that you have really trusted relationship with that are very active in the market, just through those five relationships, you can have access to hundreds and hundreds of conversations because every single day they're having those conversations on space needs.
Yep. Real quick, in terms of the math on paying them, your view is pay them all day. It's a marketing fee. Because you talked about overwhelming demand in Toronto, but do you still feel like the value prop is there? Fill the office faster with a broker?
Yes. I think that in hot markets like Toronto, you certainly, there's a lot of demand, there's a lot of supply, so that they have a lot of choice. But I would say in the smaller markets, it's even more important. Because in smaller markets, you're going to recycle those same relationships over and over and over again. So it's extremely important to pay them well, to pay them quickly too, so that they see the value proposition of bringing those clients to you and calling you and making you their first call. That's my goal, is that they give you that first call once they have that requirement.
And even in a market like Toronto, where there's so much demand, you're still perfectly happy to have a broker walk through the door with a client or send an email or however they refer people versus trying to fill it yourself without paying the broker fee.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I just see that as a cost of doing business.
Yeah.
In terms of it's a trusted relationship. I am more than happy to pay a real estate broker for bringing a client to our space because if they do, they're going to help us fill it and they're going to help us fill it long-term. And that's a relationship. Every time we pay a real estate broker, that's another solidified relationship.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. So that's an investment. Don't think of it as a cost of doing a deal. Think of it as an investment in the future of filling your space because those relationships will keep on paying off.
Yeah. I love looking at it that way. Kane, thank you for sharing your insights. Again, I feel like we could have you on for multiple topics. So hopefully you'll agree to be a guest again, but this was a great topic to cover today. Really helpful. We get a lot of questions about how this works. And I knew you had kind of a gold standard approach to this. So I appreciate your time and sharing your wisdom.
Well, thanks, Jamie. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. Thanks, Kane.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Everything Coworking. Be sure to click the subscribe button so you can stay up to date on the latest trends and how-tos. Until next time.